From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Democrats hold hearings on President Bush's proposed military tribunals, where secret evidence could lead to execution. No appeal to the Supreme Court. Spain refuses to extradite September 11th suspects to the United States for trial because of the death penalty in the United States. And with the help of multinational tobacco corporations, the U.S. undermines another world conference. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The military campaign inside Afghanistan entered a new phase yesterday when 500 Marines were flown in close to the Taliban's last stronghold of Kandahar. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said the Marines are being brought in to help to control the routes to and from Kandahar and prevent al-Qaeda fighters fleeing to Iran in the west or Pakistan in the east. But their presence at an airstrip 60 miles from Kandahar also suggests they could be involved in the battle for the Taliban's only remaining urban stronghold. One Marine told an AP reporter, "We're all psyched up about actually going and getting some payback." Northern Alliance troops, aided by U.S. Special Forces, continue in their attempt to crush an uprising by Taliban prisoners of war. Between 300 and 800 people are believed to have been killed inside the prison so far, many by U.S. bombing, and advancing Alliance troops are apparently under orders to kill all the Taliban left alive. 5 U.S. Special Forces were wounded by a stray U.S. bomb, what is called friendly fire. Northern Alliance forces are claiming they have finally captured the northern Afghan city Kunduz, with foreign journalists reporting summary executions of captured Taliban fighters. And 12 years after Soviet fighters were forced to withdraw in humiliation, armed Russian troops are back in Afghanistan. At least 60 armed Russian soldiers describing themselves as medical personnel have arrived in Kabul. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the soldiers are there to perform humanitarian work. The UN-sponsored peace talks between Afghan factions began in Bonn today, with regional stability and billions of dollars in international aid at stake. The 4 delegations, 3 Afghan exile groups, and the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance faced huge international pressure to make the talks a success. The U.S. has linked the prospect of billions of dollars in reconstruction aid to the creation of an interim administration and improved human rights by Afghanistan's new rulers. No women have been included in the talks, though they represent more than half the country's population. There is an observer, Seema Wali, who is there. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with women of Afghanistan about the formation of an interim government. A Swedish television journalist was killed early today in a robbery in northern Afghanistan, colleagues in a Northern Alliance's foreign ministry said. Colleagues identified him as Olaf Stromberg of Sweden's TV4 and said he was shot during a break-in at the house where he was staying. He was the 8th journalist to die in Afghanistan since the start of the U.S. bombing October 7th. In Washington, President George Bush suggested again that Iraq could be the next target of U.S. military attack and warned Saddam Hussein to let United Nations weapons inspectors into the country or face the consequences. Bush singled out President Saddam as evil and said it's up to him to prove he's not. In recent days, the president has expanded his threat to attack countries that harbor suspected terrorists to include those that develop weapons of mass destruction, suggesting repeatedly that Iraq is trying to develop a nuclear capability. The current UN Oil for Food program expires on Friday, but according to UN officials, the UN Security Council is unlikely to revise the current sanctions on Iraq. Federal officials yesterday released a draft plan of the government's response to major bioterror attacks. The report states in the event of a bioterror attack against the United States involving the smallpox virus, health authorities could impose measures as drastic as banning public events, halting regional transport, and placing entire cities under quarantine. The CDC has already developed plans for dealing with smallpox that could involve the closing of hospitals and forced vaccinations of millions of people. Two Palestinians sprayed gunfire at a bus station and market in northern Israel today, killing two Israelis and wounding 36 before police shot the gunman dead, this according to police and hospital officials. The attack in the city of Afula took place shortly after two U.S. envoys held talks with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon at the start of a mission to end the 14-month-old Palestinian intifada. Sharon greeted the mission by shunting aside Shimon Peres and replacing him with a retired hardline general, Meir Dagan. Dagan is a former Israeli death squad leader who helped assassinate dozens of Palestinians in the 1970s, helped to create the brutal South Lebanese army during Israel's war against Lebanon. Also in Gaza, Palestinian hospital officials said five children, including an 18-month-old baby, were wounded by shrapnel overnight when Israeli tanks shelled the Khan Yunis refugee camp. The Bush administration, reversing a Clinton administration policy, has told the pesticide industry it can pay volunteers to swallow doses of pesticides and use the data from such tests for its research, siding with manufacturers who say such studies are ethical and scientifically valid. You are listening to the War and Peace Report, just blocks from what used to be the World Trade Center, the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush's military order, authorized 2 weeks ago, would allow a person to be tried in secret by a military commission and be sentenced to death on the basis of hearsay and rumor, with no appeal to any civilian court, even the Supreme Court. The tribunals are the boldest initiative in a series of laws and rewritten federal regulations that, taken together, have created an alternate system of justice in the aftermath of September 11th, giving the government far greater power to detain, investigate, and prosecute people. The order has few specific details, among them that only non-citizens could qualify, that they can keep secret evidence from defendants, and that the death penalty could be imposed by a two-thirds vote. Bush's order does say the trial must be full and fair. It says the two-thirds of the military commission present at the time of the vote must agree on a conviction or a sentence of a suspected terrorist. It allows penalties up to and including the death penalty. It grants the last word on a verdict or sentence to the president or the Secretary of Defense. Tomorrow, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Patrick Leahy will hold hearings on the executive order that allows for military trials. And Democrats on the Hill say they're concerned that the tribunals will allow unusual shortcuts and limited appeal rights. A piece that ran in the Washington Post several weeks ago begins, FBI and Justice Department investigators are increasingly frustrated by the silence of jailed suspected associates of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network, and some are beginning to say that about traditional civil liberties may have to cast aside if they're to extract information about the September 11th attacks and terrorist plans. Nation columnist and Counterpunch editor Alexander Coburn joins us now with a response to these military tribunals, as well as the way the media is covering this issue of torture. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Alexander Coburn.
Morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So you have just written a column on the issue of torture and the military tribunals. Can you talk about them?
Actually, I've written a couple of columns, and if anyone wants to read them, they can look at them on our Counterpunch website, counterpunch.org. I mean, I think to take the first, you just read an extract from a piece by Walter Pincus in the Washington Post, which was the one on torture, which came before the commotion on military tribunals. And I think the way to think about it is that fuss about torture, where many liberal columnists came out and said actually torture was not a bad idea at all, really obscured the debate over the USA Patriot Act, which, of course, has drastically, as I know you've been discussing on your excellent show, has been terrible curtailment of liberties for everybody, American citizens, non-citizens, and so forth. And the debate then in Congress was, of course, ultimately only Feingold and the Senate stood out against it. And I think in some ways the torture debate, exactly at the moment when people were saying, you know, should we use thumb screws, should we use truth drugs, should we export them all to places where they really, should we outsource torture to places where they supposedly are better at it than Americans are, that really drowned out the debate at the moment when Congress could have resisted the terrible provisions of the USA Patriot Act. You had the torture thing, and then, of course, you had the military tribunals, all of which, and you gave a pretty good account of the military tribunals. By the way, there's a rather good remark about military tribunals by Robert Sherrill, a terrific journalist. He said, military tribunals are to justice as military music is to music. Obviously, it's absolutely horrifying. And anyone thinking that the ultimate voice on a death sentence would be George Bush, one of the most enthusiastic advocates of the death penalty, that's no comfort either.
And what do you think of the media coverage of the military tribunals?
I think it's been terrible. I mean, the best opinion maker on it has been William Safire. There's actually a curious, as he in the New York Times yesterday, and he really wrote the first really energetic column about, well, apart from people like Nat Hentoff in the Washington Times, I might add, Safire wrote a very tough attack on the tribunals on the 15th of November. That was his first, and yesterday was his second, in which he said there is an alliance, really, of the left and the right against the vast central mass, where most of the papers, I think, are pretty comfortable with it. You're now seeing, as with the Democrats on the Hill, really after the damage has been done. I think Bush felt that when the USA Patriot Act went through without too much trouble, there was initially some trouble in the House, of course, he felt emboldened by the relative calm in the press, by the, to me, absolutely horrifying reaction in the press from liberal opinion makers like, oh, I don't know, Jonathan Alter in Newsweek, a whole bunch of people like that. In the days and weeks when it counted, when a big showing in the press and, of course, on TV and on the talk shows would have, I think, really deterred the president and Ashcroft from putting through the tribunals, they felt fine. They felt, we can get away with anything, and they could. And now, of course, we're going to spend years and years trying to claw our way back, you know, ultimately trying to get rid of the tribunal order. The sunset provision on the USA Patriot Act, many of the worst provisions aren't covered by the sunset provision in 2 or 3 years. It's going to take a long time, the rest of our lifetimes, I think, to try and rectify the balance.
What about in talking about the issue of torture, this issue of the ticking time bomb cases?
They always mention the ticking time bomb cases. It was the rationale for Israeli torture. And anyone who studied what happened with torture in Israel, which is that it became institutionalized, knows that the ticking... of course you can invent a scenario where there's a ticking time bomb. But
explain what you mean by the ticking time bomb.
The ticking time bomb is, you know, someone, you catch someone, you know that person knows where a time bomb is in some building and the bomb's going to go off and kill hundreds of people. The only way you can locate the bomb is by extracting the information from the suspect, and the only way you can do that under this scenario is by torturing the person so they confess. And then you say, well, do you want the agony and pain of one individual versus the possible deaths of hundreds of people? And everyone says, well, yes, that's true. And it is true. You can invent that scenario, and it may have plausibility. On the other hand, what's the ticking time bomb The real ticking time bomb in torture is the fact that it irretrievably corrupts the society that practices it. In all these discussions about torture, no one ever pointed out two things. One, that torture was institutionalized in the United States up until about 1931. It was the prime way that police got people to confess under the so-called third degree. And a commission appointed by President Hoover said this is unacceptable in a society with any pretensions to fair and decent standards, and they stopped it, more or less, giving rise, by the way, to the jailhouse snitch, which was the next way the police got to their confessions. And then the other thing that's not pointed out is, of course, that the U.S. in recent years has been strongly accused by bodies in the U.N. and by human rights organizations of sanctioning de facto torture anyway. Remember that prisons in the United States have, you know, features which could certainly be construed as torture, starting with the certainty of rape for many inmates of a certain age in male prisons. And there have been many, in Chicago particularly, in the 70s, there were a whole slew of methods the police were using that were torture. And if you go back again to Israel, you can see that, and of course Israel had a major debate in the 90s before ultimately banning torture. Now they are again in the second intifada, they're using torture again. And they also, by the way, outsourced, you mentioned the general who started the SLA and in southern Lebanon.
Dagan.
The prison in Qiyam, Israel's SLA abandoned Qiyam and they went in there. Robert Fist did it, which actually I quoted, did an incredible account of the torture devices there, and he had, you know, accounts of people who were tortured there, and so forth. I'd like to revert one moment to that story by Pincus. You know, it's always been a slight mystery to me why the FBI suddenly felt they wanted to leak to Pincus, who is a national security journalist and very often a terrible apologist for the CIA, why they felt the necessity to do that.
And once on the payroll of the CIA. And once on the payroll of the CIA.
He was a sort of recruit with a promising career, and then he went into the far more shoddy and disgusting business of journalism. But I think, why did the FBI do that? And obviously it was a trial balloon, but, you know, I have heard some accounts that even now the examination of by the FBI, I've heard one claim that actually, you know, some of the methods of interrogation they're using could be construed as torture. Unconfirmed, by the way. The FBI, incident I remember reading about back in the 60s when the FBI was under staggering pressure to come up with the perpetrator of the killing of the three civil rights workers in the South. And they were under huge pressure from the Johnson administration to come up with someone. And what they did in that case was to get hold of a mafia thug. And they sent him down to the South, identified the possible perpetrator or a guy who'd know about the killings, and they kidnapped the suspect. They took him to an army base, and the mafia guy beat the truth out of him. And then they found the bodies of the three civil rights workers. I mean, outfits like the FBI, have had a good record, I believe, in methods of interrogation in recent years. When they're under enormous bureaucratic pressure and to come up with something, then they will, you know, they'll look at any method.
I was struck by a quote that you chose of Jonathan Alters, the media critic at Newsweek, as he talked about outsourcing the job. Here he's talking about torture. He says, we'll have to think about transferring some suspects to our less squeamish allies. Allies, no doubt, that the U.S. has trained, and you give some examples.
I know, isn't it staggering? I mean, as I said, that Alter, who's a horrible pipsqueak week after week, he actually managed to be frivolous about torture. That was what I found the most extraordinary thing of all. No, I mean, anyone looking, actually, in a book that Jeffrey Sinclair and I did called Whiteout, we gave a long account of, in the years after the Second World War, how the CIA took a tremendous interest in the, and also naval intelligence, by the way, in the torture methods evolved by the Germans, very often practicing on human guinea pigs in Dachau, particularly with things like truth serums and truth drugs. Of course, ultimately, one of those led to the CIA's sponsorship of LSD. But there were other chemicals that they were very interested in, and of course, the CIA, Army Intelligence, and then the CIA protected and used one of the most notorious torturers of all, in Latin America, who was, of course, Klaus Barbie. So the idea that somehow, you know, we have people out there, thugs in other countries who really know about this dirty business, is insane. If you look at it, there's a very good book by Bill Blum where he goes through this whole issue of CIA knowledge, condoning, instructing, and torture. It's one of those really hot-button issues like assassination, where if you start writing that the agency has done it, there's a volley of non-provens and, you know, mere innuendos. But the most famous case was that of Dan Mitrione, who was the central figure, as acted by Yves Montand in Costa Gavras's State of Siege. Mitrione used to work for USAID in the late 60s. He was kidnapped by the Tupamaros and ultimately killed. But the former police chief of secret police chief of Uruguay said that what Mitrione and his colleagues were doing was, so to speak, regularizing and standardizing methods of torture throughout various Latin American countries. And there's some other very chilling accounts of what Mitrione got up to. But you'll never find in all the sort of genteel discussions by people like Alter or the other liberal columnists, you'll never find, you know, any grounding in what the awful, disgusting realities of this are.
So what do you think are the chances of beating back military tribunals? There is an increasing outcry, even among conservatives, and tomorrow there's going to be the military tribunal hearing on Capitol Hill.
Well, you said even among conservatives. I have to say that, it was people like Bob Barr back in the early days of the USA Patriot Act. You know, when the Patriot Act was put up in middle September, a bunch of conservatives in the House actually led some spirited resistance. People you wouldn't normally be referring to in glowing terms on your excellent program. But now? I think there'll be a fuss. I don't think they'll dent it. I think actually Bush and his advisors did go too far. I mean, they got away with the USA Patriot Act with almost no discussion. They had a sedate discussion of torture. And then I think, you know, military tribunals, the phrase does have a pretty heavy ring to it. And particularly after chasing out the Taliban, people are thinking, well, do we really need this? But there it is. It is an order. I think ultimately it will make people, as I think will happen anyway, I think people will, look back on all this. I mean, hopefully they'll look back on, the September 11th, there won't be repeats of this terrible business. But I think people will come back to thinking, we have a president about whose legitimacy is severely in question anyway. And now he's got military tribunals, which are, of course, an absolute affront to any notion of civil rights and justice.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. It's certainly rare to hear voices like yours in the mainstream media. Even the conservatives who are talking about tribunals, for example, are rarely on television when talking about critiquing Bush's policy. And then there's on a different issue. I was watching Paula Zahn this morning on CNN interviewing Gloria Steinem about women's involvement in Afghanistan. And Steinem said something, and Zahn said, well, this is a side issue. It's not really what we're talking about. But you don't mean to say that you're actually opposed to the bombing of Afghanistan, do you? Paula Zahn almost fell out of her chair as she said this. Unfortunately, Gloria Steinem sort of backed off at that point. But Paula Zahn truly looked shocked because, in fact, I don't know if they've ever brought someone in who's opposed it.
Well, of course, I'll never hear a word against that heavenly creature, Paula Zahn, No, I mean, I wrote it. In fact, you interviewed me, a year and a half ago about, the allegations that, not the allegations, the fact that CNN had U.S. Army, PSYOPs people in its headquarters in Atlanta, and then it turned out NPR did. And these people, there were many questions raised about the propriety of having U.S. Army intelligence psychological operations personnel with CNN. But, watching CNN since September 11, actually watching CNN all the time, I mean, why did they worry? Why did they feel they needed U.S. Army people in there? It's like, that old rhyme, you can never hope to bribe or twist, thank God, the British journalist. But seeing what the man will do unpaid, there's no occasion to. CNN, you've got Paula Zahn. You don't have to have a U.S. Army psychological warfare telling Paula Zahn what to say. She'll say it anyway.
Well, I'm waiting for the CNN cooking show, since it seems to be true for everything else. It'll be led by Colonel Korn and General Mills, something like that. But if someone looked at the number of guests who have military titles, I doubt it would fall under 80% on that program.
Oh, absolutely not. I'm sure FAIR, you know, someone from FAIR is counting it up even as we speak. It's absolutely horrifying. And, of course, really it points to that thing that, you know, the TV shows are where the game is at. You can have people like William Safire thundering against military tribunals, but, you know, where the real weight of opinion, you know, that business of trying to get a critical mass going of discussion, you've got to have the TV people and the AM radio people doing it to get any pressure going, really.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Alexander Coburn, for joining us, columnist with The Nation. And he is the editor of Counterpunch. You can go to counterpunch.org. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, President Bush is talking about biological and chemical warfare. Who is responsible for the most number of deaths a year? We'll see. Stay with us.
So if you're a human being, this one is for you. From the most recessive to the dominant, all are you.
Till we do something about it. Sam, here on the War and Peace Report. In recent days, President Bush has expanded his threat to attack countries that harbor suspected terrorists to include those that develop weapons of mass destruction. While talks are currently underway in Geneva on international efforts to control a particularly deadly weapon of mass destruction, the weapon kills hundreds of thousands in the United States every year, millions more around the globe. It induces a host of deadly diseases in its victims when delivered in its most potent form, gradually attacking the body, its immune system, even its ability to breathe, and causing slow, painful death. The trafficking of this weapon is a multi-billion dollar industry and involves some of the world's most powerful corporations backed by the world's most powerful government. The weapon is not anthrax or even smallpox. It's tobacco. Global tobacco treaty talks are currently underway in Geneva, and once again, the U.S., working with the world's largest tobacco producers, is seeking to undermine efforts at strengthening the ability of countries to restrict the trade and marketing of cigarettes. Poorer countries are leading the way in challenging the United States, highlighting the stark choice between global public health and private profit. We're joined on the phone right now by Catherine Mulvey, who is executive director of INFACT. Can you describe the talks and what the U.S. role in them is?
Well, the U.S. has been taking a page out of Philip Morris's playbook here this week. In the last round of talks, they very overtly put forth positions that Philip Morris would like to see in the treaty, and they were roundly criticized for that. And so this time around, what we're seeing is the U.S. trying to clean up their image and playing a potentially more behind-the-scenes role, but getting many of the same results that they would like to see in the treaty. So it really is a stark contrast between the positions of the countries where the leading tobacco transnationals are based, the U.S. home to Philip Morris, and Japan home to Japan Tobacco as two examples, and also the European Union home to British American Tobacco, BAT.
Catherine, I just want to ask a question. Are you standing next to someone else who's also on the program?
There's a couple of other people, yes.
Right, because we're hearing an echo of what you're saying. So if you could move into another room from the other person who is
All
about
right.
to speak. Thank you.
No problem.
And go ahead with what you're saying with British American Tobacco.
So the U.S. position has been very has been very weak, and actually leading into this round of negotiations, Representative Waxman sent a letter to the Bush administration asking for an explanation of why the U.S. had taken positions that were exactly the same as those advocated by Philip Morris, and had actually seen a turnover in virtually all of the U.S. delegation since that last round, including the resignation of the head of the delegation, Tom Novotny, who apparently couldn't abide by the instructions he was being given by this administration. So it's definitely shaping up as a real struggle between those countries where the tobacco epidemic is going to have the most dramatic impact in current and future years, the countries of the African region and the Pacific Islands taking courageous positions in opposition to what the U.S. is advocating.
We're also joined on the telephone by Akinbode Oluwafemi from Environmental Rights Action in Nigeria, also in Geneva right now for the talks. Can you talk about tobacco and Nigeria?
Currently, what has been happening in the world over is a trend where the home of the tobacco transnationals are becoming very hostile to them. That is coming in terms of civil actions, litigations, and policy initiatives by government to control tobacco exposure and consumption by citizens of developed world. And the transnationals are now moving their deadly wares to developing countries where people are illiterate, they are poor, and they are already ravaged by diseases. And the situation now in Nigeria, it's an invasion of tobacco transnationals. We are having BAT has taken over airwaves for adverts, and suddenly, too, Philip Morris, which we don't normally see in Nigeria, has suddenly returned to our country, and everywhere you go, you can see packs of Marlboro. The result of this is that there is rising consumption of tobacco among our children, our youths, among the women and the poor. So what we are saying is that we want a situation whereby the developing countries of this world are protected from the vagaries of tobacco transnationals who are looking elsewhere apart from their home countries in order to peddle tobacco addiction. And this they are already doing now in Nigeria.
We're talking to Akinbode Oluwafemi and from Environmental Rights Action Nigeria, as well as Catherine Mulvey, Executive Director of INFACT, both in Geneva for the Global Tobacco Treaty talks. Now, what about the U.S. using the trade representative as a hammer for making developing countries do what the United States will not allow in this country? For example, the advertising of tobacco on television here is not allowed. And yet in other countries, saying to those countries if they prevent the advertising of tobacco on television, it would be considered an obstacle to trade.
Yeah. You see, the U.S. position at the negotiation of this treaty has been most disturbing. I mean, we have a position whereby the U.S. has constituted itself as a stumbling block against what the developing countries of this world are asking for. You know, when we talk about prioritizing health over trade, we talk about, advertisement ban, we talk about political influence peddling of tobacco transnationals. Each time all these matters are tabled before the IMB, you have the U.S. delegates coming up strongly opposing these matters. We are worried that, advertisement that is not allowed in the U.S., for instance, all the laws that already exist protecting the citizens of America against tobacco transnational, all these deadly deeds are now being allowed in developing countries. And we are saying, no, let us have it, a global treaty to protect both the rich and the poor, both the developed and the developing countries of this world from the tobacco transnationals. But here we are with a United States government saying no to all this. It is a clear cut of the American government introducing double standard policies to say, okay, we are second citizens of this world, we are first citizens of this world, which is totally unacceptable to us. We think that the FCTC should be strong enough to protect the poor countries of this world, particularly particularly from the political influence peddling of tobacco transnational. I tell you this, Philip Morris is a $63 billion corporation. This is more than the GNDP of about 3, 4, 5 African countries pulled together. And we have a trend. Recently, BAT sponsored a dinner in London. I mean, they call it Nigeria Economic Summit, where we had the president of Nigeria negotiating. I mean, as negotiation has been coming on here, we've had telephone calls to delegates from BAT offices in Africa. Now, what they are trying to do is to get through the government and use the government of these countries that they know are very weak and know are very susceptible in terms of economics. They want to get to this government, get closer to them, and then have a weakened treaty so they can continue the destruction. I mean, they can continue to spread diseases and tobacco addiction in our countries. And we are saying that the U.S. government, I mean, the U.S., which is home to these transnationals, should be able to ensure that there are curbs to their companies going out, crossing the waters to other parts of the world to inflict all these pains and, I mean, all these pains and all this addiction in our people. But we see a trend, you know, that is happening in the tobacco negotiation. I mean, we see Chevron, we've seen Mobil go to the Niger Delta, you know, cause a lot of environmental damage, you know, I mean, work together with the local community, I mean, the local government, to kill and maim our people. I mean, the same is happening in this tobacco debate, where the U.S. delegation is saying you can go anywhere you want to go in the world, you can spread tobacco addiction, you can get people killed through your product, but bring back home the dollars.
You're listening to Akinbode Oluwafemi from Environmental Rights Action Nigeria. Is Reggie Guevara standing by, Akinbode?
Yes. Can I put him on?
Yes, if you could, because we've lost him on the other phone.
Hello?
Reggie, hi. This is Reggie Guevara from the Center for Alternative Development Initiatives in the Philippines with Akinbode and Catherine in Geneva. Can you talk about Philip Morris in the Philippines?
Yes. Actually, like 10 years ago, the Philippines had already enacted laws requiring 30% of the package space for health warnings. Unfortunately, the transnationals like Philip Morris have challenged these laws with the judiciary. It's only around 2 months ago when the Supreme Court has ruled these laws constitutional. More recently, in July, Philip Morris had groundbreaking rights for their $300 million manufacturing plant. And unfortunately, no less than President Macapagal Arroyo was the guest of honor.
You also have the case in Malaysia of the U.S. threatening international loans to the country. Malaysia, which has one of the most successful public health anti-tobacco initiatives, unless they allowed for the free flow of tobacco.
I think Kathy might be able to say something.
Catherine
about
Mulvey.
Well, that's actually that is just one in what has unfortunately been a pattern of behavior by the U.S. Prying open Asian markets in the late 80s and early 90s on behalf of the U.S.-based tobacco transnationals, and as you said, you know, fighting domestic legislation that was passed to protect public health as barriers to trade. And it's something that the Clinton administration had moved away from, but we've already seen the Bush administration turn back in the wrong direction over the summer by threatening South Korea with trade sanctions over tobacco tariffs. And so this is one of the issues that actually has been the hottest here in the negotiations this week, the question of whether public health should be prioritized over commercial interests and other international agreements. And it's one of the – it may be the only place in the draft text that currently exists where there are two exact opposite clauses in there that are being negotiated, one of which says that public health takes precedence over trade, and the other of which says that this convention has to fall within the limitations of other international agreements. And the lines have been drawn there. It's really the U.S. and Japan that are most aggressively pushing for trade rules to take precedence. And actually, fortunately on this issue, the European Union has broken with its cronies and is joining the African region and the Southeast Asia region in fighting that.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Reggie Guevara, as you go back to the Philippines, the Center for Alternative Development Initiatives coming from Geneva and this World Tobacco Conference, what do you take with you, and especially against the backdrop of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan? Do you see any connections?
Well, actually, the Philippine delegates here are very strong advocates of a strong FCTC, particularly about the influence peddling, particularly about the health over trade. We just have to mobilize the NGO community in the Philippines to make sure that that this treaty will be ratified by the Senate.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Reggie Guevara, Center for Alternative Development Initiatives in the Philippines, Akinbode Oluwafemi from Environmental Rights Action in Nigeria, and Catherine Mulvey, Executive Director of INFACT at infact.org, where a major report has recently been released by the organization on the World Tobacco Company. Stay with us. Cradle and All, Ani DeFranco here on the War and Peace Report. This is Refugee Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. An editorial in yesterday's New York Times reads, "As soon as German U-boats put eight saboteurs on U.S. shores during World War II, one of the eight called the FBI to betray the mission, but was brushed off as a crackpot. Days later, he called again and managed to persuade the FBI he was an authentic saboteur. Partly to keep this embarrassment of bungled enforcement from becoming known, the eight were secretly tried by a military court inside the FBI headquarters. Unexpectedly, a U.S. Army lawyer assigned to the Germans mounted a spirited defense, Colonel Kenneth Royall, citing the landmark 1866 Supreme Court decision of Ex parte Milligan, holding that martial law could not be applied where federal civil courts were in business, challenged the secret tribunal's legality. FDR told his attorney general, according to Francis Biddle's memoirs, that he would resist any Supreme Court decision to give the accused saboteurs a regular court trial. I won't hand them over to any United States marshal armed with a writ of habeas corpus. Confrontation was averted when a cowed Supreme Court unanimously acknowledged the extrajudicial power of a president armed with a congressional declaration of war. Six of the eight captives went to the electric chair. J. Edgar Hoover was awarded a Medal of Honor. Now, President Bush, with no such congressional declaration, is using that Roosevelt mistake as precedent for his own dismaying departure from due process. The column is not written by an activist, a human rights lawyer, or someone who has herself experienced the injustice of a military tribunal. It's by the conservative New York Times columnist William Sapphire. Unlike any other action since September 11th, Bush's unilateral creation of a military tribunal system has unified voices across the political spectrum in protest. Reluctant U.S. allies in Europe are also finally putting their foot down. Spain, which caught and charged eight men for complicity in the September 11th attacks, last week refused to turn over the suspects of a U.S. tribunal ordered to ignore rights normally accorded foreign defendants. Other members of the European Union are expected to follow. European allies might also be suspicious of President Bush's creation of a secret tribunal, since it happened just days after House and Senate negotiators prohibited any U.S. cooperation in the establishment of the International Criminal Court. The ICC is being established in the Netherlands to prosecute war crimes, genocide, and other crimes against humanity. We're joined on the telephone first by Maria Carrion, former producer of Democracy Now!, who went back to live in her home country of Spain, where there was a major development this week, and it was around the issue of the death penalty in the United States. Spain arrested a number of people it believes to be linked to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and yet Spain also said they would not extradite these suspects to the United States because they could face the death penalty in the United States. Maria Carrion has long covered the death penalty. Can you talk about public opinion in Spain now?
Hi, Amy. It's good to be with you. Yes, I mean, public opinion is very, very much against the death penalty here in Spain. And I have to say that the Spanish government's refusal to extradite has probably got more to do with that. And it's the fact that Spain is a part of the European Union than anything else. And we have quite a conservative government, the Popular Party, the PP, and José María Aznar, the president of Spain, is actually proven to be a close ally of George Bush and received George Bush when he was over here in Spain a few months ago with open arms. But public sentiment is against the death penalty. We had a citizen of Spain who was released from death row just a few months ago after he was retried in Florida and found innocent. So I think even if Aznar wanted to, and I believe privately he probably would want to collaborate closely with Bush, he probably couldn't get away with this.
And the European Union, of course, as you were saying, Spain being a part of it.
That's right. Well, you know, European Union members largely are not, they cannot have the death penalty. I believe, I'm not quite sure, but I think that Britain does have the death penalty for high treason. It's sort of a very rare thing that's never used. But in general, European Union members do not have the death penalty. For instance, Turkey, if they ever joined the European Union, would have to give up the death penalty. So I think that Spain is obliged not to. They're the first country that has been asked to extradite, and so they find themselves in this predicament. But I think any country in the European Union would have to do the same thing.
Well, I want to thank you, Maria, very much for joining us. Maria Carrion, former Democracy Now! Producer living in Spain. And in our Firehouse studio, we're joined by Reed Brody, who is the Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch and has just returned through a tour of various European countries, including Spain. Reed, the significance of, I don't know if you can call it Spain's defiance with its conservative government, but on this issue, I guess you can.
No, I think it's very important, and the reasons given were not just the death penalty, and I should add to what you said that countries of the European Union have a firm policy for several years of not extraditing suspects to the United States without firm assurances that those suspects will not receive the death penalty. Spain, however, also cited the fact of the military tribunals. And said that, according to reports, that it would be a violation of the fair trial provisions of the European Convention on Human Rights for Spain to extradite somebody to face this kind of kangaroo justice. So I think it's very significant. And as Maria said, Spain has a conservative government. President Aznar is going to be here in the United States, I believe, tomorrow to meet with President Bush. The Spanish public opinion is something else. That's actually, I think, slipping away from support for the United States. And interestingly, when I was in Spain, days I was in Spain, there were terrorist attacks by ETA. There was a terrorist. I arrived from New York after 2 months in New York. Arrived in Spain, and that morning, while I was in traffic, there was a terrorist attack by ETA. And the next day, ETA killed a judge in the Basque Country. And I think one of the big differences between Europeans and Americans, frankly, is that Europeans have not lived this sheltered life. They have become painfully accustomed to dealing with terrorism. And yet they do it without the, I mean, there are serious abuses going on in Europe now, which maybe we could talk about, but they do it without the death penalty and without, wholly throwing out the rules of due process.
Now, you were, among other things, going around countries dealing with, well, what might be called the cases of terrorists, but terrorists the United States has supported. Not that if Osama bin Laden is responsible for this, he wasn't also supported by the United States.
That's right. One of the issues I was dealing with in my various stops was the question of the ongoing prosecutions against people like Pinochet. And there's actually a case open against Pinochet still in Spain, still in France, still in Belgium. In fact, next year there's going to be a trial in absentia in France of Pinochet and some of his collaborators. The case of Hissène Habré, the former dictator of Chad, who is now being held in Senegal for extradition to Belgium. Interestingly, tomorrow, a Belgian court of appeals will hear legal arguments on a case against Ariel Sharon that was filed in Belgium for the massacre in the Chabra and Shatila refugee camp. Israel's lawyers actually are objecting to the jurisdiction of the Belgian court.
And what is the jurisdiction of the Belgian court?
Well, Belgium, like a growing number of countries, has incorporated provisions that are vaguely are generally termed universal jurisdiction. That is, that certain crimes are so heinous that they're called crimes against humanity and can be tried by any country. Belgium has taken it one step further and said we can try these crimes even if they have no connection to Belgium, just as Spain did in the Pinochet case, in fact. Spain indicted Pinochet on the basis of his acts in Chile, essentially, against Chileans. A growing number of countries, in keeping with their obligations under the new International Criminal Court, are adopting laws that expand their jurisdiction over atrocities. And of course, the International Criminal Court, which is the centerpiece of all of this, will come into existence probably next year after the 60th state has ratified the treaty. I think there are now 45 or 46, 46 as of yesterday, states that have ratified this treaty. And so whether the United States likes it or not, and obviously the United States doesn't, this court is going to be up and functioning probably mid to late next year in The Hague.
Let's talk about that for a minute, the International Criminal Court. Often the response is, we have to do something against terrorists. And so the answer has been to bomb Afghanistan, saying what other forum is there? Well, you mentioned that the U.S. has been fighting an International Criminal Court, but can you talk more about that?
Well, the United States has been a proponent of international justice for Rwandans and for Serbs and for Khmers and for Sierra Leoneans. What the United States objects to, particularly about an international criminal court, is its independence, that an international criminal court could potentially indict Americans or American allies or particularly American policymakers. The Pentagon essentially wants to be able to, to prosecute wars in the way that it sees the national interest is requiring, without a bunch of international judges looking over their shoulders and saying this is illegal, that's illegal. I think that's really the heart of the matter. The case of Osama bin Laden is somewhat more complicated. Obviously, any country that captures Osama bin Laden would have jurisdiction over him because his crimes or his alleged crimes are crimes against humanity. So if the United States captured him, the United States would have jurisdiction to bring him to justice. Interestingly, the same question would arise if another country captured Osama bin Laden. If a European country captured Osama bin Laden, it would be very difficult for them to extradite him to the United States for the same reasons that Spain has just evoked with the al-Qaeda detainees in Spain.
Which is probably why there's been some prickliness on the part of the British troops moving in. On the one hand, the U.S. is trying to put together this international coalition. But when the troops actually move in, the U.S. doesn't want them there.
I would assume that it would be very problematic for the U.S. And for Britain if British troops were to capture Osama bin Laden. That's right.
You mentioned France going to try Pinochet. And I know that a French court wanted to question Henry Kissinger in regards to the Pinochet case, in that case. What about Henry Kissinger in regards to an international criminal court?
Well, obviously, the International Criminal Court is not going to have retrospective application. So, no crimes that have been committed in the past would be reviewed by the International Criminal Court. But I think the Henry Kissinger problem is what the United States is worried about with an International Criminal Court. It's not the case of the poor American on a peacekeeping mission whose rifle goes off and kills a civilian and is prosecuted for politically motivated reasons, which is what is often alleged. I think what the U.S. is worried about is that an international court will find that policy decisions made by high-level policymakers violate the laws of war in the future, and that's what the U.S. is worried about.
So you've got, for example, Pinochet, a U.S.-backed terrorist of Chile. You were talking about Habre. Can you mention a little more about him?
Well, Hissène Habre was the ruler of Chad from 1982 to 1990, and he was supported by the United States as a bulwark against Muammar Gaddafi. According to Bob Woodward's book, The Veil, Alexander Haig said that the support of Habre was to, in order to, quote, bloody Gaddafi's nose. The U.S. Then supported Habre with millions of dollars a year with intelligence information. Right now, a team that I work with is in the capital of Chad going through the archives of the secret police and finding considerable evidence of United States complicity, not just in supporting the regime of Habre, but actually with the secret police. There are people who talk about Americans coming into the headquarters of the secret police, of Americans training members of Habre's secret police. This is a police that is alleged to have killed upwards of 40,000 people and to have engaged in systematic torture from 1982 to 1990. Hissène Habre fled Chad after his overthrow. He was arrested last year in Senegal. He was under house arrest for a year until the Senegalese court said they didn't have the laws appropriate to try the case. And the president of Senegal has now said, I'm holding Hissène Habre. If Belgium wants to extradite him, they can come and take him.
So it's interesting, back with our discussion with Alexander Coburn, quoting Alter, Jonathan Alter from Newsweek, talking about the issue of torture here and whether it can be used, and saying, well, maybe we'll have to subcontract it out to our less scrupulous allies, allies trained and financed and what, right, for by the United States.
Well, of course, it would be, just as it would be illegal for Spain, under Spain's principles, to extradite somebody to receive a treatment, i.e. an unfair trial and a death penalty, that that person could not receive in Spain. It would actually be a violation of American law and of international law to send somebody to a place that he would be tortured. That's a cardinal principle of international law. Not only that you can't torture, but you can't send somebody to be tortured.
And yet now they don't have to send them out, considering what they're considering in the United States right now, the military tribunals and torture.
That's right. Well, I mean, the military tribunals, I think, you know, it's very encouraging to see all the opposition to it. I didn't hear your discussion with Alexander Coburn. Obviously, in all our interactions with the government, it denies any intention to commit torture. And, you know, you don't have anybody on the record saying that.
Reed Brody, Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch, thanks for being with us. That does it for this hour of Democracy Now! in Exile. It's produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Salone is our engineer and music maestro. We're broadcasting also on WBIX.org on the internet at democracynow.org. We hope you visit our website. Thanks to KPFA and KFCF in Fresno, to all our Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. We're here at Downtown Community Television. Our host, John Alpert, and Keiko Suno. We're broadcasting on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Public Access TV in New York, channels 34 and 56, CUNY TV, and public access stations around the country. Also on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network. In Exile, from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of The Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! in Exile. As the mainstream media cheers the talks in Germany on the future government of Afghanistan, human rights activist Medea Benjamin leads a delegation to Afghanistan to find out what women want. public health crisis should the government be allowed to force patients to be vaccinated, take over hospitals, and seize drug supplies. We'll have a debate. And we'll hear reflections of a Palestinian-American woman living in fear in a post-September 11th world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The military campaign inside Afghanistan entered a new phase yesterday when 500 Marines were flown in close to the Taliban's last stronghold of Kandahar. One Marine told an AP reporter, "We're all psyched up about actually going and getting some payback." Northern Alliance troops, aided by U.S. Special Forces, have killed the last of hundreds of Taliban prisoners of war in Kunduz who launched an uprising and then refused to surrender. U.S. warplanes launched up to 30 airstrikes overnight against the prison where Taliban fighters were originally detained following their surrender over the weekend. Victorious Northern Alliance troops swept into Kunduz in brutal style yesterday, shooting wounded prisoners and leaving them to die in the city's marketplace as they ended a two-week resistance by Taliban forces in their last stronghold in northern Afghanistan. And 12 years after Soviet fighters were forced to withdraw in humiliation, armed Russian troops are back in Afghanistan. At least 60 armed Russian troops describing themselves as medical personnel have arrived in Kabul. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the soldiers are there to perform humanitarian work. UN-sponsored peace talks between Afghan factions began in Bonn today, with regional stability and billions of dollars in international aid at stake. The four delegations, three Afghan exile groups, and the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance face huge international pressure to make the talks a success. The U.S. has linked the prospect of billions of dollars in reconstruction aid to the creation of an interim administration and improved human rights by Afghanistan's new rulers. We're going to talk about women's role in a new Afghan government tomorrow, when women from Afghanistan join us in the studio before a conference they'll be having here in New York on Thursday. A Swedish television journalist was killed early today in northern Afghanistan. Colleagues identified him as Olaf Stromberg of Sweden's TV4. They said he was shot during a break-in at the house where he was staying. He's the eighth journalist to die in Afghanistan since the U.S. began bombing October 7th. In Washington yesterday, President Bush suggested again that Iraq could be the next target of U.S. military attack and warned Saddam Hussein to let United Nations weapons inspectors into the country or face the consequences. Bush singled out President Saddam Hussein as evil and said it's up to him to prove he's not. In recent days, the president has expanded his threat to attack countries that harbor suspected terrorists to include those that develop weapons of mass destruction, suggesting repeatedly Iraq is trying to develop a nuclear capability. Federal officials yesterday released a draft plan of the government's response to major bioterror attacks. The report states that in the event of such an attack against the U.S. involving the smallpox virus, health authorities could impose measures as drastic as banning public events, halting regional transport, placing entire cities under quarantine. The CDC has already developed plans for dealing with smallpox that could involve the closing of hospitals and forced vaccinations of millions of people. We'll have a debate on this plan later in the program. Two Palestinians sprayed gunfire at a bus station and market in northern Israel today, killing two Israelis, wounding 36 others before police shot the gunman dead. The attack in the city of Afula took place shortly after two U.S. envoys held talks with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon at the start of a mission to end the 14-month-old Palestinian intifada. Sharon greeted the mission by shunting aside Shimon Peres and replacing him with a retired hardline general, Meir Dagan. Dagan's a former Israeli death squad leader who helped assassinate dozens of Palestinians in the 70s and who helped to create the brutal South Lebanese army during Israel's war against Lebanon. Also in Gaza, Palestinian hospital officials said five children, including an 18-month-old baby, were wounded by shrapnel overnight when Israeli tanks shelled the Khan Yunis refugee camp. The Bush administration, reversing a Clinton policy, has told the pesticide industry it can pay volunteers to swallow doses of pesticides and use the data from such tests for its research, siding with manufacturers who say such studies are ethical and scientifically valid. The new policy, which the Environmental Protection Agency has not announced, disregards the recommendations of a scientific panel. The policy could have a significant impact because it comes as the government is beginning to reassess about 9,000 pesticide safety levels to reflect their impact on children. President Bush said the recession officially declared Monday should act as a clarion call for Congress to quickly approve an economic stimulus plan. Congress is locked in deep partisan disagreements over economic stimulus, with Bush administration officials stressing corporate tax cuts and Democrats insisting on new help for the unemployed. And Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle said yesterday he has no plans to rush a ban on human cloning through Congress. President Bush, joined by a chorus of religious and political leaders, condemned the work of a Massachusetts biotech company that said this weekend it had created human embryos through cloning.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end and you're gonna rock the other, it's the same boat, brother. Oh, Lordy, look down. Come is a holy place. He said, Lordy, me, what a sea of space. What a spot to launch the human race. So if you're on board for a mixed up crew, with eyes of black and brown and blue, so that's how come that you and I got just one world and just one sky. We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end and you're gonna rock the other, it's the same boat, brother.
We're in the same boat, brother, Leadbelly, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. Marines secure Afghan foothold. Alliance captures final city in north. Taliban may surrender key southern area. Afghan leaders in diplomatic lockdown. These are a few of today's top headlines from the mainstream U.S. papers, but the silences are deafening. Talks on the future government of Afghanistan opened in Germany today, with U.S., Russia, Pakistan, Iran, and others exerting strong influence from the sidelines. The talks are between four factions: the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance, a group of exiles backing former King Mohammed Zahir Shah, and two smaller exile groups. The media reports the German foreign minister's opening appeal to forge a truly historic compromise that holds out a better future for your torn country and its people. But scant attention has been paid to the fact that of the 25 delegates at the table, only two are women. And the UN Children's Fund told journalists yesterday, Afghanistan's fast approaching bitter winter, combined with lack of security left by the U.S. bombing, could leave 100,000 Afghan children dead in the next few weeks. Epidemic diseases spreading through Afghan refugee camps near Iran have already claimed the lives of hundreds of children in the past few weeks alone. But no major U.S. paper has reported the story. Well, the San Francisco-based human rights group, Global Exchange, is going to where the silences are. Global Exchange has sent a delegation of four women to the Pakistan-Afghan border, where they've spent the last week talking with refugees. The women will enter Afghanistan in the next few hours to talk to women about what they want for their country. We're joined on the phone by Medea Benjamin. She's founding director of Global Exchange and former Green Party senatorial candidate from California. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thanks for having me on, Amy. It's nice to hear your voice.
Well, it's great to be with you. Medea Benjamin joins us from Peshawar. What are you hearing right now?
We've been visiting the refugee camps and speaking to Afghan refugees for the last 5 days. And, Amy, the stories are just heartbreaking. I've never met a people that have experienced so much suffering over so many years. We've been going into people's homes, which usually consists of one room with up to 15 people trying to squeeze and sleep inside of it. Children who don't have enough to eat, people who've been traumatized because everybody has lost somebody. And what is also overwhelming is the number of people we find who have fled since the U.S. started bombing, and how difficult life is for those recent refugees. In fact, more difficult than for the refugees who have come here in earlier years.
And the bombing is continuing.
Well, the bombing is continuing, and there is a flood of about 2,000 Afghan refugees into Pakistan every day now. And these refugees are considered illegal refugees. In fact, they have to sneak in through a border that's been closed, and they're not allowed legally inside the refugee camps, which means they don't get UN support. They don't get a tent. They don't get a house. They don't get rations. They're not on the books to have their children go to the clinics or the schools. So these are the ones who are really suffering from the U.S. attacks, and the ones who are really left to fend for themselves. We find many, many women still in their burqas, I might add, who are on the streets begging. We visited clinics where they say about half the children are malnourished. And once again, we want to stress that most of these people are people who have come since September 11th.
Can you talk about what they say about the U.S. bombing?
Well, there is a lot of contradiction in people's own minds, because when you hear the horrible stories of the...
Medea, are you there? Well, we sometimes have this trouble with the telephone where occasionally it just cuts off completely. She may well be able to hear us. Medea?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, we can hear you again, so go ahead.
So I was saying that while people are very contradictory about their feelings towards the United States, they were so anxious to get rid of the Taliban, but everyone tells us also about the abuses they suffered under the Northern Alliance. And they feel that the United States has not demonstrated that it is really making a commitment to the Afghan people. In fact, everybody says...
There it goes again. This often happens where, especially if we tape people during the day, they will go off for a minute. They can hear us, and then they come back. Medea Benjamin is with us from Peshawar. I think she's back. Are you there, Medea?
Yes, I'm sorry. Is the phone line going in and out?
Yeah, it's going in and out. You don't have to shout, though, when you're speaking, because it's easier to hear you when you don't. Go ahead with what you're saying.
So I was saying how in the people's attitude towards the United States is they want to see what the U.S. is going to put into reconstruction. People understand that...
Well, we will try it one more time. Again, here she is again. Go ahead. People understand that. I rarely hear silences when I talk to Medea Benjamin, but I think this has nothing to do with what's in her power right now. Again, Medea Benjamin is on the border, and she's in Peshawar with several other women from the Global Exchange delegation. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, Amy, just fine.
Okay, keep going.
So,
well,
towards the United States. Did you lose me again?
Say that last sentence again.
People are very contradictory in their attitude towards the United States. They are not trusting that the United States will put money into feeding the massive number of refugees and rebuilding the country. So there is a general feeling of skepticism about why the United States is bombing Afghanistan and what it will do when the bombing stops.
You know, it's interesting. I was just watching CNN where Paula Zahn was interviewing Gloria Steinem about women's involvement in the bond talks. And as a side issue, Paula Zahn said about something Steinem had said, "You're not saying, are you, that you are opposed to the bombing of Afghanistan?" She was absolutely floored that anyone would express anything like that. But let's talk about the women of Afghanistan, what role they will play, and how much their voice is being heard. Medea Benjamin.
Well, we are very excited, as are women here, that there are women that are included in the talks happening right now in Bonn, and the separate talks that will begin this Saturday in
Berlin for civil society, and there have been at least 20 women that have been invited to that. The problem is that this has been chosen in a very undemocratic way. For the meeting in Berlin, the United Nations that has chosen which women are to be invited. So women here are gathering in many wonderful organizations that are run by women, and I must say we've been so impressed by the women doctors and lawyers and women running the schools and women working with street children and all kinds of women that have proven over many years their dedication to the poor of Afghanistan. But these women feel that there should be a much better process in terms of determining who should represent the women of Afghanistan.
Is it your understanding that only of women representing the Northern Alliance are included in these talks, though there are other observers?
Well, our understanding is that there are a few other women who have been invited, but that in the meeting of the civil society, there have been quite a number of women invited. At first, it was only going to be men, but there was so much pressure on both of these meetings that women be included. And that pressure is coming not just from the international community, but is really coming from both inside Afghanistan as well as from the exile community. And some of the most important women in terms of women who have played roles in the government of Afghanistan in the past are now living in exile. They are highly skilled, and they have been waiting for many years for this moment. And they are the ones that are putting a lot of pressure on the United Nations, on the Northern Alliance, on the King and his representatives that they be included.
Finally, Medea Benjamin, the issue of refugees being allowed into Pakistan. Marines say they're there to stop refugees from going into Pakistan, supposedly to stop the Taliban from moving into Pakistan. But that also means how many refugees and how able are they to get over the border?
It's very difficult for them. We've talked to elderly people in their 70s and 80s, women who just gave birth and were taking babies that were a few days old, and how they had to walk and walk and walk through the mountains and able to get to a part of the border that was not being monitored and then slip through the border. And then, of course, once they're inside, because they're not there legally, they have all kinds of trouble, not only not getting the rations that the UN is supposed to give to refugees, but they're also at the mercy of the local police who know that they are there illegally. And these people are working for next to nothing because this is a very poor country in Pakistan itself, and having to absorb millions of refugees from Afghanistan has been very difficult. So the Afghanis are at the bottom of the totem pole and work literally for sometimes $1, $2, or $3 a month.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Medea Benjamin joining us from the border from Peshawar, Pakistan, where she is with a delegation of women who hope to go into Afghanistan. Yes, Medea?
I just wanted to say, yes, we'll be entering Afghanistan tomorrow, and this is the road that has been where the four journalists were killed, which is why a lot of people are waiting on the border until it's safer. So we're going halfway in tomorrow into Jalalabad, which is the safe part of the road. I should add that the area here between Pakistan and Afghanistan is really seen right now as the Wild West, with nobody being in control. And it is a terrible security situation, not just for the journalists and the foreigners, but more importantly for the people who are living there. And the ethnic divisions are being heated up as the Northern Alliance and the Taliban situation is getting more and more difficult. But I would also just like to add that Global Exchange, when we get back, will be doing a lot of work to be promoting women's voices during this whole transition period. And we look forward to your listeners getting in touch with us so that we can work together to make sure that women are included in the new government and that the U.S. does put massive amounts of money into taking care of the refugees and to reconstructing Afghanistan.
Madia Benjamin speaking to us from Peshawar, Pakistan. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to look at public health measures that the administration is putting forward in emergency situations. A debate. Stay with us.
And I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
I see skies of blue, clouds of white, a bright blessed day, a dark sacred night, and I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
Colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky.
Also on the faces of people passing by.
I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? What they are really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry, watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I say to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
Victoria Williams and Vic Chestnut, What a Wonderful World, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Since the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, the Bush administration has relied increasingly on a rhetoric of national security and public safety to justify restrictions on civil liberties. So far, the Bush strategy has centered on immigration and criminal justice, including the detention of over 1,100 people and the creation of a military tribunal system. Now, the Bush administration will expand this approach to another frontier, public health. While most states already possess emergency health statutes, the president is pushing states to adopt a law that will vastly expand their powers. The act would grant authorities new powers to take over hospitals, seize drug supplies, quarantine people exposed to infectious pathogens, and draft doctors to treat them. It would also give them permission to force patients to be vaccinated and order police to restrain residents from leaving contaminated areas. The proposed legislation is known as the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. The CDC commissioned a Georgetown law professor, Lawrence Gostin, to write the act at the height of the anthrax scare and then rushed it to state legislatures as soon as it was complete. According to the Washington Post, some variation of the measure is expected to be considered in virtually every state in the coming year. But public health experts, civil libertarians, AIDS activists, and others have begun to raise serious questions about the CDC template. We're joined right now by Lawrence Gostin, who wrote the legislation commissioned by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, director of the Center for Law and Public Health at Georgetown University. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Can you lay out what the basic tenets are of this bill?
Well, the bill requires all states to have in place emergency plans for a possible bioterrorist attack or for other novel and emerging infectious diseases. It requires them to have good surveillance so that there's an early identification, early warning system, if you will, for bioterrorism, and also good communication between public health, law enforcement, and emergency management. And then it provides a set of powers in relation to property, for example, things like vaccinations and pharmaceuticals to ensure that there are sufficient supplies, and then also deals with issues involving individuals in terms of their vaccination, testing, treatment, and as a last resort, isolation or quarantine. I think that's a short précis of a very long, complicated but important bill.
On the issue of vaccination, would it require vaccination in some cases, like, for example, smallpox?
Yes, it would require vaccination. If there was a highly infectious disease and there were a vaccination available, I think most, if not virtually all, sensible people in the country would agree that there would need to be vaccination. And if a person didn't want to vaccinate themselves, then there could be compulsion. I think you could perhaps imagine sending an unvaccinated child to a school where smallpox was a possibility of exposure.
We know the situation of forced vaccination because particularly of the military during the Persian Gulf War, and a
right.
lot of people believe that there were serious problems with those vaccinations that led to Gulf War syndrome. Smallpox is a very, the vaccine can have very serious consequences,
yes.
comes with a great risk. How do you force people to take a vaccine that could kill them?
Well, the chances that they would be killed by smallpox if they're unvaccinated would have to be much greater than the chance of them being harmed by the vaccine. It's true to say that many vaccines, and including and perhaps particularly smallpox, do have risks, but the risks are exceedingly low. I would not be in favor of vaccinating the population in the absence of an outbreak, but if there were an outbreak of smallpox, people might just forget the devastation of infectious diseases. The disease itself would be far worse, far more costly to human lives than the vaccination. I mean, it's really they can't even be spoken in the same breath. The risks are so different.
We're also joined on the telephone by George Annis, who is chair of the Health Law Department at the Boston University School of Public Health. You're concerned about the proposal that has been put forward, the proposed legislation by the CDC, written by Lawrence Gostin, on the line with us. Can you talk about your criticism?
Well, basically, I think this is a solution for a problem that we don't have. I mean, as Larry just said, he envisions maybe some people not wanting to get their children vaccinated, or maybe one or two strange people not wanting to get vaccinated. That's not going to be the problem in a bioterrorist attack. The problem is going to be panic, and the problem is going to be what standards are applied to people when we quarantine whole cities, what you do in that kind of an epidemic. And I think that deputizing a whole bunch of public health workers, giving them badges, and giving them arbitrary powers to order doctors to treat people, to order people to be treated, to order people quarantined, is just exactly the wrong way to go, because it treats American citizens as if they're the enemy. The people you want to catch and quarantine are the bioterrorists, not the American citizens who are trying to do whatever they can do to cooperate. And we know from the anthrax attacks that Americans are not resisting treatment. Americans are demanding treatment, are lining up to get treatment. It's the CDC that's telling them to go away. It's the CDC that's saying you don't have to take Cipro. In fact, don't take Cipro. That you don't have to be screened for anthrax if you weren't directly exposed. So I just think this is a statute that comes from the 19th century. It doesn't help us. In fact, it's counterproductive to the issues that we face right now.
So what do you suggest?
I suggest those first things that Larry talked about, emergency planning, stockpiling vaccines, trying to coordinate federal and state efforts. All those things, however, are not going to be touched by state legislation. These are issues that require federal legislation, like the Frist-Kennedy bill on bioterrorism, which I think is exactly the way to go. And I think the CDC actually thinks that's the way to go, too. I think if you talk to any public health people, they will tell you what you need now is funding. What you need now is new vaccines. What you need now is new drugs. What you need now is more work on the bioweapons convention. What you don't need are more extraordinary, arbitrary powers that public health people don't really know how to exercise.
When you talk about the bioweapons convention, do you mean the bioweapons protocol that the U.S. walked away from this summer?
Yes, I mean the one that the president first said in the spring that we're not interested in because the inspection is too bad on our pharmaceutical companies. They really don't like it. I think we have a new view on that now, that we need heavy-duty international inspection to make sure that scientists are not developing new pathogens for which we have no vaccines and for which we have no defense, and that the only way to deal with those is first-line prevention, which is to prevent the pathogens from being developed in the first place, that these kind of new weapons of mass destruction are what we should be aiming at, again, trying to prevent their development, not trying to figure out how we can quarantine Americans in case they're attacked.
We're also joined on the line by Dr. Keith Richmond, who is a Republican California State Assembly member who's working to adapt the CDC proposal into legislation for California. Can you lay out what your bill will look like?
Yes, good morning, and thank you very much for having me on the show. My bill is modeled after Dr. Gostin's template. Let me say that I think it's a very important bill and a bill that sets up a framework for preparedness for the state of California in the case of a bioterrorist attack. I think it's very important to differentiate between diseases. If we're faced with a bioterrorist attack with an entity like smallpox, we're looking at potentially 30% of the people who contact the disease dying from the illness. And I think it's very important that the state is prepared for that type of situation. Certainly what Dr. Anna said about having provisions for planning, stockpiling of pharmaceuticals and other supplies, coordination of state and federal and local responses are all very important, and in fact are part of Dr. Gostin's template and part of my legislation. Besides that, the bill does address issues that are potentially very controversial and very contentious, but I think need to be debated in an open discourse like we're doing here this morning. Issues of quarantine and isolation of patients, treatment with vaccinations are all very difficult issues, but I think are important to discuss and debate before we're faced with the situation so that it can become part of our planning and, in fact, the coordination of the state, federal, and local response.
We're also joined by Tanya Ehrman, who is Director of Public Policy at AIDS Action, which is a network of over 3,000 AIDS service organizations around the country. You've expressed great concern about the CDC proposed legislation and what the states will adapt. Can you talk about it specifically in reference to AIDS?
Sure, and thank you for having me this morning. I think a couple of the points that have come up about where we're going with this language and what's going to be happening, I think the same kind of questions we're talking about today have come up with everything that we've been talking about with Department of Justice and other entities. You know, when do state powers become so broad that they threaten the American way of life? The definition of a public health emergency that is contained in the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act is so broad that it encompasses HIV and AIDS. It could encompass the flu or hepatitis. And when we talk about something so broad and then overlay that with something like smallpox, well, you know, you talked about the vaccine and whether there would be people who would be unwilling to take a vaccine. From the AIDS perspective, we've been left out of this vaccine. We would be, you know, as eager as anyone else in the case of a public health emergency to get our hands on a vaccine, but we know that the smallpox vaccine that exists right now is not safe for us, is not safe for our community. And so we have lots of things to work through. And in terms of having an open debate to talk about these issues, it seems like because of the situation we were in, we have not had as much open debate prior to these guidelines being released into the public's view, before to talk about these issues, before now they're being sort of adopted by people like Dr. Richman and other states around the country. You know, things like quarantine and isolation and names reporting and closing facilities that are known to harbor disease are perfectly, maybe perfectly reasonable in the case of smallpox. But when you put that from, you know, in an AIDS lens, that's quite different. And the issues that come up for us are quite different. We're 20 years into an AIDS epidemic in this country, and we know what works in HIV prevention and AIDS care. And names reporting is something that's decided at the state level, and quarantine and isolation are certainly not things that we are interested in seeing occur, you know, within our community.
Dr. Gostin, author of the legislation proposed by the CDC, your response?
Well, I'm glad you had me on, because there are a lot of misconceptions floating out there, and I'd like to clear them up. A number of things that George said I certainly agree with. Very thoughtful, intelligent. He had said what public health professionals want. Do they want more money? Yes. Do they want a better infrastructure? Yes. He's absolutely right on that. And in fact, America has the public health system it deserves because it's been chronically underfunded. But public health professionals also want modern, effective laws. In fact, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers and the National Association of County and City Health Officers, all the health officers in the country, are strongly supporting this bill. So if we want to know what public health people want, they do want modern, clear laws. The term arbitrary has been used a number of times. This statute is the furthest from arbitrary that I can think of. It's been carefully looked at by the Department of Justice, by attorneys general across the country. It has very, very clear standards. And it is true, of course, vaccination and quarantine would not be needed very often. In fact, I hope it isn't needed. But the idea that someone could refuse a vaccination or would be refusing to be isolated when they're infectious and to mingle around the population, no common sense view would allow for that. And what this law does is far from be a violation of civil liberties. It tightens up standards, rights to individuals that don't exist under the current law. And then finally, Tanya's point. Again, I think Tanya makes a very good point. We do know what's effective for AIDS, and we do not intend for this law to affect the AIDS epidemic. In fact, we've written commentary. There's commentary now that shows that this is not the intent of the drafters. We're talking about bioterrorism or novel infectious diseases, not endemic diseases like flu or AIDS. So I wanted to reassure the AIDS community that this is not intended to affect them.
Tanya Ehrman, are you reassured?
Well, I'm glad to hear that, but when people around the country are already taking what exists now, and I appreciate that it's going through sort of a comment and revision period and using it, you know, we've sort of put something out on the table already. And so I'm very concerned that, you know, notwithstanding Professor Gostin's comments, that states are going to enact what they're seeing right now on paper, and that could give them broad authority because the definition right now includes epidemics and pandemics, and that certainly, you know, we certainly qualify in that criteria, and that all of these things could start happening. So, you know, it's a matter of sort of where we talk to people and where they are in their process, and also what occurs at the federal level and how tight that language is.
Keith Richman, your response, and especially on the issue of naming names, for example, and issues of privacy.
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, let me say also that I have no intention of including AIDS in this bill. And let me also say that the legislative process is one that works out these type of issues, and the way that you get the open debate in a legislative process is to propose a bill and then hear it in the legislature and work out these issues of concern to people. The issue of privacy and naming names in a bioterrorist attack with smallpox is very important. There's no question that the civil liberties are different in a situation where 30% of people might die. It's important that public health authorities, public safety authorities, have the information and the ability to share information trying to prevent 30% of a population from dying.
Tanya Ehrman, your response.
It's very important that extraordinary steps be able to be taken in that type of public health emergency.
Tanya Ehrman.
I don't disagree with any of the comments. I was a public health professional myself. I don't disagree with any of the comments about what kind of situation we would be in if we were facing smallpox. That is clearly a very different situation in terms of the transmission of the disease and everything else than we've talked about in the AIDS community. But I will just again bring up the point about the smallpox vaccine that currently exists, which does not work for us. And that, you know, I've been heartened to see some people around the country starting to talk about the need to develop a better vaccine, because the vaccine we have now is inadequate, and some of it gets back to funding issues, because unless we spend some time and resources on doing some work to get a better vaccine, instead of helping people with the vaccine we have in the case of the AIDS community, we will be harming a great number of people.
We're going to have to wrap up the discussion here, but I will just raise on the issue of State Assemblyman Keith Richmond saying that this is why we need a full discussion of these bills, that in a time of national emergency, it seems it's precisely, and we see it now since the bombing of Afghanistan, precisely a time when there isn't that space for open discussion, when issues of questions are raised as issues of patriotism. Keith Richmond.
Yeah, no, I think it's very important that an open discussion be held. This is not a bill that is going to quickly fly through the legislative process. I certainly recognize the issues in the balance between civil liberties versus the potential state powers in this bill during a public health emergency. And I look forward to an open debate. It's not something that I think in any way should be pushed through quickly. I respect and recognize the issues that are being brought up, but I think it's very important on everybody's part to be well prepared for potential situations, not only well prepared on supplies and stockpiling of medications and planning, but also well prepared by having the proper public health framework in place. Let me also say on the issue of vaccines, I also think that that's very important. Whether it's an AIDS patient or other immunocompromised patients, it is important that we develop a better vaccine and have more vaccine available as quickly as we can. But it's also very important to understand that the smallpox vaccine we have is by far and away safer than the situation where someone instead would contact the disease. There is just no comparison, and as Dr. Gostin said, they can't be said in the same breath. The potential of death in a normal population is somewhere between 1 and 10 people from the vaccine out of a million doses. In contrast, we would be talking about 30% of the people dying from a smallpox infection.
I want to get George Annis' response as well as Dr. Gostin, but we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll be back. Keith Richmond is Republican California State Assemblyman working to adapt the CDC proposed legislation for California. Lawrence Gostin is with us, professor of law at Georgetown University. He is the author of the CDC legislation. We're joined on the telephone also by George Annis, who's at Boston University School of Public Health, and Tanya Ehrman with AIDS Action. And we are going to continue this discussion in just a minute.
Oh, the trouble with the truth is it's always the same old thing. So hard to forget, so impossible for me to change. And every time I'll be left to blame. Oh, the trouble.
The Trouble with the Truth, Patti Loveless, here on Democracy Now in Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be looking at women's involvement and the reconstruction of a new government of Afghanistan. And we'll also be hearing from a Palestinian-American professor talking about here and there reflections of a Palestinian diaspora. But right now, we're talking about the legislation that has just been made public by the Centers for Disease Control, proposed legislation known as the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. It was the CDC commissioned Georgetown Law Professor Lawrence Gostin to write the act at the height of the anthrax scare, and then rushed it to state legislatures as soon as it was complete. According to the Washington Post, some variation of the measure is expected to be considered in virtually every state in the coming year. It's a front page story of the Washington Post today, beginning, if bioterrorists attack the United States with smallpox virus, health authorities could impose measures as drastic as banning public events, halting regional transport, and placing entire cities under quarantine. The plan by the CDC calls for stepped-up awareness by doctors, health officials, public, to be able to detect any outbreak of smallpox, a disease officially eradicated from the planet 21 years ago, and to be able to respond quickly enough to stop it before a pandemic can sweep the nation. We're joined by Lawrence Gostin, who wrote the legislation, Keith Richmond, who is working on the plan for California, Tanya Ehrman of AIDS Action, and George Annis, who is chair of the Health Law Department at Boston University School of Public Health. I'd like to go a little further into what it would mean to shore up the public health system in this country. For years, people have not particularly cared about it. Most policymakers do not address this as an issue. Sort of public health is equated with health for the poor, except at a time like this. George Annis, you heard Dr. Richmond, the California State Assemblyman, saying you're talking about smallpox that could kill 30% of the people, so you have to change your whole approach, and it does involve treating, I suppose, people like the enemy to save them. What is your response?
Well, first of all, I think it's extraordinarily short-sighted to do this disease by disease. I mean, Ken Allaback, for example, who's the Russian defector, who's probably the world's expert on bioterrorism, thinks that there are at least 52 existing pathogens that can be used in a, successfully in an attack, and that people who want to attack us with bioterrorism could use any of these. And if you're just geared up for one, it doesn't do anything for the other 51. And it does, so that, I think, is extraordinarily short-sighted. The most important point to make, and the one that I think has not been well understood by the public health community, is that bioterrorism has radically changed the nature of public health. Up until 2 months ago, public health was universally seen as a local and state problem. In fact, under the Constitution, the states have the police powers, the health and safety powers, that make them the ultimate arbiters of public health. That is no longer true. In a bioterrorism attack, that is a national issue. Under the national security powers, the defense powers, it will be the federal government who has to respond. The federal FBI will be called in. If it's a crime, the military will be called in. If it's an actual attack by another government, this is no longer a state and local issue. Yes, they'll be the first responders, but the idea that they can somehow avert a national, a national epidemic when bioterrorists attack, that you have to worry about what the individual states are going to do, other than being first responders and calling the military and the FBI and the CDC, is, I think, absurd. The world has changed, and public health, I think some public health people have recognized it, but obviously some people have not.
So where do you take this, then? I mean,
where do you take it that this is a federal issue, that really the Kennedy-Frist bill you have to do, you need a – no state's going to develop new vaccines. No state is going to develop new treatments. No state is going to work out an emergency plan. That's why it was the CDC. It wasn't the state of California that came out with this plan today for how to deal with smallpox. It was the CDC. This is a federal issue. And I think that, you know, we could spend time. I'm happy to debate this issue state by state. But the individual states are not going to solve the problem of bioterrorism. That's not where the problem is. And it's not a legal problem. You can pass all the laws you want. And Congress and the states love to pass laws because it's free. They don't have to spend any money. But to rebuild the public health infrastructure, you're going to have to spend a lot of money. And it's going to be federal money, not state money.
And that money should go to what?
That money should go to building the infrastructure, putting in the monitoring systems, making sure all the departments of public health all have access to what's going on in terms of what drugs are being dispensed at pharmacies, what diseases are being found in emergency rooms, to training the first responders, training the people in emergency rooms, the physicians and nurses, training the fire department and the police department and the public health people as how to respond. But mostly that response is going to be to call the feds, to call the feds in and get this thing under control.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lawrence Gostin, you talked about intent being different than what you're hearing, the criticism of how it could play out. But you're talking right now about the Bush administration. You're talking, for example, about a Justice Department that is talking about military tribunals, perhaps even torture, about detaining people, not giving out their names. So does your original intent really matter here?
Yes, I think that intent and language does matter. Whether or not one agrees with military tribunals really isn't the issue with the Emergency Health Powers Act. One of the reasons that, in fact, perhaps the most important reason that I agreed to have my center do this bill was because I wanted to make sure that it had proper respect for persons and treated all groups with integrity and decency. And so the law throughout is very attentive to issues of procedural due process and justice and equal protection and fairness. So that is very important to me because, as you said, and all the guests have said so rightly, that we do face, you know, delicate balances and trade-offs between individual rights and public goods. I think that public health and safety has been undervalued, and we need to value it more in our laws and policies. And as George rightly said, absolutely, in terms of the kinds of money and investment we need to make in public health, that is more critical than the law. But the law is also important, and I think that this bill is not perfect, but it can be made much better, and we can and should modernize our laws. We haven't done that in the public health system for 100 years, and it's time that we all kind of came together and worked on this as a community. I might also just mention one other thing about the federal-state issue, if I could. Of course, it's correct to say that the federal government plays a large role, but it's equally correct to say that the states and localities are very important to this. And what we need is not to set up a distinction or a distraction between federal and state and local. We need to actually have them work as partners, and that's extremely important in any forthcoming epidemic.
Do you see universal health care as a part of this whole issue?
Well, I would love to see it personally, and I'm sure all the guests would. It hasn't been brought up on the table, but if you think about bioterrorism, for example, if somebody goes into the emergency room or to their doctor with an exotic or strange illness, the last thing in the world we want to happen is to have the doctor say, well, how are you going to pay for this? So we should not ask that question. Universal health care is extremely important to America. It was before September 11th. It's even more so now.
Keith Richman, you're of the party, not that the Democrats don't side with you, but has not supported universal health care.
Well, let me say that I proposed the most sweeping comprehensive bill to cover the uninsured in the state of California in this past year. And I do believe that it's very important that not only people are covered in a health plan, but that our health care infrastructure has been terribly underinvested for years, and not only am I concerned about our ability to handle a bioterrorist attack, but here in California, we have a tough enough time handling a bad flu epidemic. Let me follow up on a couple of the other comments made by Dr. Gostin and Annis, if I could. I also believe it's very important that state and local municipalities are able to respond quickly to a public health emergency. There is no question that within the first state level, not at the federal level.
Then I just want to add this before we have to leave this discussion, and that is you have, for example, the anthrax vaccine that's created by a company that was privatized from the state, run by one of the former chairs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, William Crow. It's considered extremely, it has not been approved by the FDA, seriously questionable. What Gulf War veterans have said, they're very concerned caused their sickness.
Approved. It's the company that's not approved.
Right, and so you have the situation of privatization of the drugs that people would be forced to take, and serious questions about the efficacy and the safety of them.
There are, in fact, provisions in the bill regarding the safety of vaccines, and there's no question that the safety of any vaccine needs to be considered, and, in fact, the safety of any treatment or whatever we're going to do in a disease needs to be considered in contrast to what would happen otherwise. Those are the types of decisions that we routinely make in medicine and public health, and in fact need to be discussed again openly so that we're prepared for these types of situations. The bill does not only address smallpox. As Dr. Annis was saying, there are numerous other diseases, whether we're talking about plague, tularemia, brucellosis, or hemorrhagic viruses that could be potentially used, like Ebola, for bioterrorism. And the bill addresses the potential for all of these illnesses and again, sets the framework for the state, local governments to be prepared for that type of situation.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. It's a discussion we will continue to have. Dr. Keith Richmond, Republican California State Assemblyman, working to adapt the CDC proposal for California. Dr. Lawrence Gostin, professor of law at Georgetown University, who wrote the legislation that's just been put out by the Centers for Disease Control. George Annis, chair of the Health Law Department at the Boston University School of Public Health, and Tanya Ehrman, director of public policy at AIDS Action. That does it for the program. We'd like to hear your comments. You can mail us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. We had help from Lizzie Ratner and Suganya Mahendra. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We're broadcasting on the internet at WBIX.org and our website, democracynow.org. And you can get all links to our guests from there. Thanks to KPFA and to KFCF, to all our Pacifica affiliates airing us around the country. We are Pacifica. Special thanks to Downtown Community Television, where we're housed, John Alpert and Keiko Suno, and Manhattan Neighborhood Network. We are broadcasting on WFMU in New York and Pacifica Station affiliate stations around the country. You can also hear us at Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of the Dish Network. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, and the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.